Welcome to Life Lessons in Unexpected Places. The world is full of teachers if you know how to look and listen. With Asha Nayaswamy, one of the spiritual directors of Ananda Palo Alto and a founding member of Ananda Worldwide. If you enjoy this content and are inspired by the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda and his disciple Swami Kriyananda, find Asha on YouTube, Facebook, Patreon, all podcast directories, and her website, ashajoy.org.
Food for the heart. Were God never to nourish our hearts with His love, our very devotion for Him would become desiccated, like a river after years of no rain. I used to teach the beginning meditation classes in our temple here, our Ananda Temple in Palo Alto, the teaching center that we've had here for decades. And when Ananda first came here in 1981, and then when I moved here in 1987, we were kind of the only game in town, is the only way I could put it. It was very much at the beginning of the movement toward meditation. And our Ananda Center was one of the few places at that time in the whole area that offered these regular meditation classes. Now meditation has become, you know, we're now 30, 40 years later, meditation has become almost mainstream. The library, the YMCA, you know, the bank, the sports teams, everybody is recognizing that some kind of inner awareness. The movement is largely fueled by mindfulness, which takes away the whole God question and just has you sort of paying attention to your thoughts and concentrating, and it's very beneficial. It's not in any way as if I don't think it's tremendously helpful. But what we have always taught and what I continue to offer is meditation with God realization as the goal, which is quite different. I've heard many prominent teachers, especially Buddhists, even very prominent Buddhist teachers, talk about a non-deistic, is how they phrase it. It means there's no deity. There's just the experience of your own consciousness. Well, I think it's very valid and very attractive to many people. It's not attractive to me. It's not that it's not beneficial, and I'm not in any way, as I say, saying it doesn't serve a lot of people really well, but it's never served me. I've always had too much heart into what I was doing and too much motivated by a desire for bliss and a desire for a transcendence of my own limitations. And I could never figure out how I was going to transcend my own limitations unless I was connected from the beginning to a reality that transcended my own limitations, merely to pay attention to my own inner self, which is also fundamental to the practice that I follow. But I couldn't end there because my inner self just wasn't interesting enough for me. And in fact, many times, anguishing. The phrase that Master uses in Autobiography of a Yogi, Yogananda uses, is he said, after a time, and he's talking about reincarnation and many lifetimes, we develop a certain anguishing monotony about the whole thing. It's kind of oxymoronic to talk about both anguish and monotony at the same time because they don't seem like they would match. The very nature of monotony is that it isn't dramatic and it doesn't have an intensity to it. It's just monotonous. And anguish is certainly the opposite of that. But it's the monotony itself that becomes anguishing. It's a brilliant bit of wordsmithing, which I have always really respected, because even though we go through it again and again and again over many incarnations, there's still a monotonous quality to it, which is no matter what happens, no matter how many things we go through, we always end up more or less in the same spot. One of the powerful motivators to put me as seriously onto the spiritual path as I have been since I was 18, since just before my 19th birthday, was a long contemplation, which I seem to remember as keeping me awake for most of one night, but I don't know if that was literally true, in which I imagined the hour of my death. I was 18 years old at that point. Death was hardly about to come. I'd never been with anyone who died. I'd never seen anyone die. Subsequently, I have, been privileged to be present at the passing of a number of people. But at that point, I hadn't. But if we think about reincarnation, we've died many times. I could feel it. I could feel everything that I called myself and everything that I was defined by and attached to in this world, and all the people who loved me, whatever would happen, and all the people that I loved, I would still be absolutely alone with my consciousness. And there was an anguishing monotony to that. It's the only way I can put it, which is, what would my consciousness be? And would I still be as limited in my identification and my self-definition as I was sitting there, lying there at the age of 18 or 19, thinking about it? I couldn't bear it. And it became a tremendous motivation to develop my inner consciousness. And once I really started wanting to develop my inner consciousness, I could see that there had to be an influx of higher awareness from some source other than me. And so I could be as mindful as I could possibly be about my reactions and my responses and how I was dealing with the world, but it was a closed system if it was just my own ideas. And I'm quite creative and very energetic in my mind, so there was no lack of willpower or of dynamic will, dynamic energy flowing through and creative possibilities. But there was a natural ceiling on it, which I later came to define as quite simple as ego, which is, as long as I was only experiencing my separateness, then it wasn't going to be enough. The word that came to me only later was what I was suffering from was the unbearable limitation of my own state of awareness. And the reason I found it unbearable, I had always found it unbearable, I just didn't know what was causing me to suffer. I didn't have the vocabulary for it. And interestingly, I wasn't unhappy, but it was always just this lurking question as I grew up. You know, when are we really going to get to the real event here? I thought when I was a child that everybody around me had a knew the deeper purpose and the deeper meaning of life. They were just waiting for me to get mature enough so they could share it with me. But as I went through my teenage years and got to know my teachers a little better and got to know more adults, I began to realize that they just didn't know. And that was when a certain, as Thoreau called it, I believe, quiet desperation began to set in, which was solved by the advent of Swami, first just by the advent of Vivekananda, Swami Vivekananda, through books, because he'd already passed, and then Swami Kriyananda in person. But the end of it was, the ego, I could become very, very skillful with my ego. And I don't mean that in a negative way. It's very good to become very skillful with your ego, able to accomplish, to articulate, to focus. I mean, the ego is your friend. It's just, he can't do everything. It can't do everything. There needed to be a connection and an open doorway to some other reality, which is why Autobiography of a Yogi, and for me, Swami Kriyananda himself, were so powerful, because in Autobiography of a Yogi, from the very beginning, the author, Yogananda, he's a devotee. He loves God. He loves Divine Mother. He's powerful in himself. There's no diminution of the persona that is Yogananda. But that persona lives. It's very deistic. That persona lives in relationship to this higher reality. And it's the relationship with the higher reality that really animates his spirit. Through Divine Mother as he worships, through the saints that he meets, ultimately through his guru, through his own experience of cosmic consciousness. He wrote a poem called Samadhi, where he talks about just leaving. A samadhi means, you know, infinite awareness, just leaving this world behind completely and simultaneously seeing this world, but seeing it as just shadow and light, which just covers this blazing light of infinity, which is the divine. And so all of this, and So coming back to when I was a meditation teacher, which I did for many years here, I taught the beginning meditation courses. In trying to orient people, not merely to be mindful, but to actually be meditating in the way that I was there to share with them, there's many ways you can learn to meditate, and you need to do that which suits you. Because look how different we all are, everyone. Every single one of us is unique. And we have a unique construct, inner construct, that will lead us down a certain path. And, you know, that which is appropriate and feels right to you might not feel right to anyone else that you know. But it will be your path. So I'm not making judgments here. But the path that I have been commissioned to share has certain characteristics. So early on in the beginning meditation classes, I would explain to people like this: meditation is a relationship. It is true that you're cutting off your participation in the external world as you're used to thinking of it through the senses. What we can see, what we can hear, what we can touch, what we can taste. Our senses, we move outwardly, we experience the world, and we take those experiences inside ourselves, but our belief is that they emanate from outside. So then we become more, I'll keep using the word mindful. We become aware of what the inner world is doing. We become familiar with what our inner world is doing. So we interiorize our energy. That's important. Then we raise our energy. We become more elevated in our awareness. But then beyond that, we have to transcend it. And what we have to transcend is our limitation. That this very I, this very ego self, which I have always thought of as the definition of me, is actually just one tiny little dimension of myself. We are literally a pyramid, but with the point downward. And that downward point is where we are now. We are in this body with this ego identity. We are the most contracted that we can possibly be. And our consciousness opens out in this huge funnel, which literally expands into infinity. And the meditation as Kriya Yoga, which Yogananda describes in Autobiography of a Yogi, that's what we call our practice, which is a specific way of meditating with multiple steps toward the final initiation into Kriya. And all those multiple steps can be learned by anyone. But what we're doing is we are putting what we have thought of as ourselves into an open relationship with a greater reality. And we can use words that people don't react to, like a greater reality or superconsciousness or infinity or eternity. Or I like the word God, and I like the word Divine Mother. I like the word Guru. These are all words that are part of that funnel opening up. And whatever window or door you walk through, we're all walking into the same infinity. Whether you call it Jesus or Krishna or Buddha, wherever you call it, we're all expanding. And if you think of all the points of our pyramids all being together, you begin to see when the triangles begin to expand that we begin to overlap. We start moving into each other's territory until we've all moved into everyone's territory. Now, the nature of a relationship is that it's two directions. And so it's not merely that I am giving or I am offering or I am surrendering. It's that we are relating. And one of the wonderful aspects about the truth about life, the reality that we can experience about life, is that at first we may have to use our imagination to try to visualize and feel what that relationship would be, but we're using our imagination to anticipate something that's actually there. So this isn't just a subconscious projection. And see, this is where, as Master called it, this is the science of religion. This isn't a dogma. This is if you do the proper experiment. And that's why we teach people to meditate. If you watch your breath, if you listen to the inner sounds, if you tune into the chakras, if you do the right pranayams, if you focus in the right way, if you arrange your thoughts and your attitudes in a certain way, it's not then that then you will be conforming to a dogma that will promise to save you. It is that you will be attuning to yourself to a reality that's actually there. And this is what Swami says. He calls it food for the heart. Were God never to nourish our hearts with his love, our very devotion for him would become desiccated like a river after years of no rain.
Our work is made possible by inspired listeners, so if you feel to support Asha, you can make a one-time donation, or for unique members-only content, subscribe through Patreon. Blessings, and thank you.